Are you ready, Brian?
Yep.
Okay, what do you have?
The Diabolical Principle.
Oh, the book by Wyndham Lewis?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Oh, I just want to say this. I want to thank Kim Raymond, R-E-I-M-U-N-D. I don't know who this person is, he or she, but he or she regularly contributes music every week. I usually pick one or two of his choices. Very good. Keeps me up on what's happening, I guess, sort of like the mainstream of indie world or something. So let's give a hand for Kim for providing some neat new stuff. I want to recommend that. Okay, maybe Kim will identify their self some point, call in or something. All right. Okay, Brian, this is a book about 1931 or 1932. This is McLuhan's copy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what stands out there? Oh, I want to say that's the book where Lewis makes his statement, you know, I'm part fascist, part communist, part Quadrophenic,
right.
Part Bob, you know, that famous quote.
Right. There's a page number note of McLuhan's. He's got a few dozen of those, and one of them is to his L's Declaration of Principles. And, yeah.
Does McLuhan comment on that sentence? Or that statement?
No.
Okay.
Just in the, it's just, there's a note to it in the back.
Ah, just just a note, a page number.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
And, yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, he noted that one, definitely. There was a...
Is there a way you could read it? Let's hear how it's presented in the book, because I think it's from...
Oh, I don't have that quote on me right here.
Oh, okay.
Here.
Yeah, he first said it in an issue of The Enemy in, like, 1929, and then some of those articles in The Enemy became part of the book, the Dithyrambic Spectator and something. What's the name of the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Diabolical Principle and The Dithyrambic Spectator.
Right. Okay, what do you want to note?
At least of what I saw, there's not, I mean, McLuhan clearly read it closely and noted a lot of things, but he didn't necessarily write a whole ton of notes beside things, but there sure are a lot of great quotes and places that have classic McLuhan, like where he refers to that principle that establishes a blind spot on the brain where it comes into contact with irreducible standing outrages,
mm-hmm.
and McLuhan has underlined blind spot on the brain with EOM, effective media, written beside it.
Effective media, wow. He got that from Lewis.
Yeah, that's right there in the Diabolical Principle. And there's a big theme in this book about the public's sort of... rearranging of the role of audience, public, clear division between the spectacle and the spectator or something, and where people become more participant.
Yes.
He analyzes a whole progression that he claims that they're at a halfway point where everyone's a critic.
The new romanticism.
That's true. That's what he calls it, the new romanticism. Isn't that right, Brian? Does he say new romanticism?
It's in there, for sure.
Yeah.
But carry on with
your point, Brian.
He's critiquing the whole... because McLuhan had written a center/margin, C/M.
Yeah. The audience is getting in the act, is what McLuhan later said.
Right, and that's very much in the quotes here. I'll just read this bit of a quote. In short, there is
Is this going to be Byron and Shelley?
No.
Wyndham Lewis.
I'll have to mute you.
Book. Haven't you read the book?
Which book? Which book?
Byron and Shelley?
The Diabolical Principle.
Yes, he read it. He's reading from it, Ion. Let him say it.
That's the reason we ask about... Okay.
Yeah, just relax.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, Brian. It's just,
so shortly on the next page after this, where he underlines the blind spot on the brain idea, and there's the quote, "In short, there is a price upon the man-ape's head," as in the kind of, you know, there's a war on for our minds being the sort of the meaning, like the head, your mind is being targeted.
Right.
"In short, there is a price upon the man-ape's head. Contrariwise, his specialized organs receive many flattering attention. The standard of workmanship when a fine art is one of the arts of life is necessarily high and exacting." And beside that, McLuhan has the center slash margin. "But none of the pictorial and plastic arts, at least, are today any more than an adjunct to the critical and historic faculty. The contemporary audience is essentially an audience of critics."
Yeah.
"They are, that is to say, as active as the performer, who indeed exists chiefly in order that the critic may act as a critic."
Awesome. And that C minus M means center without margins, or centers everywhere, boundaries nowhere, is what McLuhan means by C minus M.
Yeah, although that this one was a C slash M. It was center and center with margin, because he was beside when talking about the previous situation of specialized fine arts. But then there's one more note. He also wrote print as environs beside this this idea of the pictorial and plastic arts becoming nothing but an adjunct to the critical and historic faculty in writing, and just becoming just content for basically the newspaper or critic in a writer or magazine.
Yes, and McLuhan said the printing, the Gutenberg Galaxy, ends up on the sidelines in the 20th century. That's C/M as center with margins, which was created by the centralizing effect of the printing press. And so he's saying that the audience is beginning to get in the act. They have literate responses. They have points of view at first.
Yeah, that's why it's a halfway into the act, because the main target of his criticism here is this magazine transition, right? And so he's basically analyzing what is this transition, like what they're very obfuscating about and grandiosely unclear, opaque pronouncements about their transition, like what is this thing?
Yeah, this is Eugene Jolas.
It's a new romanticism.
Yeah, that's where Ion's right. Eugene Jolas is the critic who founds Transition, and McLuhan wrote later that the Transition people never understood Joyce. They went on about James Joyce creating the new word, celebrating the word, but Joyce was more than that. And Lewis is analyzing what McLuhan would adopt later is the problem with the Eugene Jolas and Marie Jolas gang in Transition. Transition magazine.
Right. And that gang is the surrealist avant-garde art that has a revolutionary kind of a feel about it.
The new romantics, that's what they are. The retrieval of that.
Yeah, and so they're imagining a transition. Like the very last paragraph of the whole book, there's a note beside that one that's nice and dark. He says, but this is describing this transition, and with the critic... that the critic is like these arts existing primarily so the critic can get it, can act as a critic, and it's the audience getting in on it. He's describing this as a halfway point, is part of the transition. It's a way station on the way to this other, like, primitive reality they want to evoke, where, like, it's halfway to, and he does describe in a pretty, a sort of an American Idol voting plus social media, where later on, but it's hardly
the popularization of disgust. The popularization of disgust.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the main theme in there.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian. Read the quote.
The one I was saying before, where to act as a critic, that continues. The only rationale of the professional artist at the present moment is to provide the critic with material for criticism. It is no longer to give delight or to serve any useful end. And beside that, McLuhan says, art no longer for training perception. And then at the bottom of that page, he writes, it's also written, when everything is art, there is no art.
Right. Is that McLuhan says that?
Yeah, McLuhan wrote that at the bottom of the page on this one.
Right. Now, I remember Eric used to say that in his class in 79 at the Ontario Art College. Now, Croker in Data Trash talks about, I think it's Data Trash or Spasm, that art today in the 80s, 90s exists for the critic. So there's Croker
right.
replaying an idea that Lewis got, you know, 60 years before. And,
yeah, that's
and so I would say Croker's part of the Android meme. The Android meme's replaying McLuhan, who's replaying Lewis. That's part of the meaning of my chart. You've got McLuhan as the Android meme extension replaying Lewis, and then Croker replaying McLuhan, Lewis, and everybody with a robotic emphasis, a digital robotic point, a high-tech point.
Yeah, absolutely. The chart, like, you can... You can trace those influences of the anatomy of the chart of that. It's something that's before. It's not
yeah.
something new under the sun kind of thing.
But Lewis is way ahead of everybody. You see how McLuhan can get the jump on everybody by focusing on Lewis. I mean, Transition Magazine is not encouraging people to read Lewis at that point. They do not like Lewis. Lewis is the enemy, and he's criticizing them precisely, and they're ignoring him.
Yeah,
so,
that I should dwell in this analysis upon such a perfectly fundamental question as the intensive manufacture of hatred can need no excuse. In one form or another, it is a capital ingredient.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Do you recognize that, Brian, that quote?
Yeah. Yeah, that's from there.
Is it from that page, you mean?
Oh, it's from that book. It's from either right near the beginning or...
Page 81, right. We'll help you.
you watch. It's not 81, but it is in the original edition, which you don't have.
Okay.
Is it page 81?
Yeah, that's around this section.
I
the other most important theme.
One has been too horizontal. I wish to be vertical.
Right.
Is that on page 81, Brian?
That quote, I don't know. That was that last.
Oh, you don't have the book. That's right. I actually have the book. I can look it up. I'll look it up.
Lord Suffering Kent. It's in the library. Just past the garage.
That's right. I can go look it up.
But that the area of the book that Ion is quoting from is the other. Really important theme, and McLuhan does have a note about this, that section, a couple pages later, the vulgarization of disgust, and then the leads to hatred of dupes.
Right.
Yeah, so a little bit of the, I'll try to quote only the most essential bits of the Lewis. Yes, okay. Disgust has been vulgarized.
That's
this is
Lewis.
More deadly. Yes, this is Lewis. Disgust has been vulgarized. This is more deadly in its effects than the vulgarization of knowledge. The natural insolence and desire for a feeling of superiority of those who are superior in nothing but money and the power it gives is thus provided by this vulgarization of disgust. And the noble pessimism of the speculative mind is at once translated into acts and employed as a sanction for exploitation. A little, and this is the... He's talking about this philosophy of the creation of the what the public wants philosophy has this vulgarization of disgust behind it. A little later he says, hatred of stupidity is the most dangerous thing to encourage in yourself or others. It must have as a policy or widely indulged in practice the most diabolical results.
Wow. Ion, that's Harry Crosby who kills himself around this time. 1929, 1930. Is that the rich boy Harry Crosby's product? Is the aristocrating of disgust? Would you agree with that, Ion? Harry Crosby and his mistresses? Where's iron? Is the iron still here? Let me check.
Maybe
that.
Maybe more ex-proliferations.
Okay. What does McLuhan say to that? He just repeats the phrase vulgarization of disgust there in the margins?
Actually,
from which I can pick plums at will.
No.
Plums at will. Okay, go ahead. You know, at the end of my replay of the Knot magazine interview that I highlighted along with this magazine on Facebook, I also featured Jerry Belanger's interview with me for his press kit for the Bosmie Calls album, and he ends by saying, stop, Bob, after I said a mouthful, my brain hurts. And I go, want a plum? So there I am predicting Ion.
Yeah, that's a good ending. I like that.
Yeah, what a plum. Did Lewis say that, Ion, this plum thing, or are you quoting someone else?
No, it's in that book you've been talking about.
Okay.
I think that's plum with a B, too, about plumbing some depth. Or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The plum and square is a big theme of Ion in the early years, during Ion's blue period, before Carolyn would believe him. He emphasized the plum and square, or something like that.
Okay.
The plum and square,
yeah.
Carolyn?
I think so.
That's what you were upset by, right? The plum and square, the Masonic thing. Pre-Masonic. Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
Wait a minute. Why don't you go into the political Philistine?
Yeah. Maybe I should go get the book while you do that.
I didn't. I wasn't able to take any notes on that subject of the book.
Oh, yeah, you don't have the book. Okay, you read some quotes, I'll get the book.
Will never be able to escape in future on the score that their personal evidence has not been taken this once at least.
Nice one, Ian.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Brian.
With our friends Paul Jolas and Faye,
that's page 20.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Ian. Go ahead, Brian.
On page 93, we have, but with our friends Paul Jolas and Phage, after he's talking about the hatred of stupidity, he's talking about with the transition.
That's the vulgarization of vision. The vulgarization of vision.
Yeah. Another sort of vulgarization of disgust, even more disgusting. I refer to the vulgarization of authentic and lofty detachment of the Superman, of a Shakespeare, a Pascal, or a Machiavelli, and of the... pardon me, I can't read my own writing right now. Oh, yes. The vulgarization of the penetrating truth of their vision of life, which made matchwood of all human disguises and embellishments, for the use of a swarming intellectualist and artistic tribe of sub-supermen. Got the quote there about the sub-supermen on page 93 there.
Nice.
It's, the most dangerous.
Go to 75. Go to 75. The hatred as a necessary drug.
Yeah, we'll get to that. The Superman theme, Brian.
Very clear, too, on the subgenius influence of the... That's definitely a... There's definitely a vulgarization of that the lofty detachment thing.
Yes.
Vulgarization of the authentic and lofty detachment of the Superman for the use of a swarming intellectualist and artistic tribe of sub-Supermen.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be that, but it has ended up that way.
Yeah, I had a thought there. What was the thought just before? Oh, yeah, Superman. You'll see the character John McKenzie in Lewis's novel about Toronto, which has McLuhan as John McKenzie. McKenzie and the Lewis character, who's Rene Harding in the novel, they discuss the Superman aspect a lot, I remember, in the novel.
Okay.
And the worst of all possible Philistines. And the worst of all possible Philistines. 119.
Okay. I'm just getting near the book. Very good. Give us another McLuhan quote.
You know,
Brian,
you cannot move that on the other side. You cannot move. Bob, you're going to move all that over there. It's right there on the side. Do not disturb all that. Get right there. You'll never get to
I got it.
You know better.
Yeah, yeah. I got to wash my hands now. Okay.
You better know that's right. Lord, suffering cat.
So what is it? You said page 20 and then 119? Page 20.
Okay. Page 20 is the political Philistine. And then
right.
you go on
yep.
down to the popularization of disgust is 82. The
yeah.
vulgarization of division is 93. Oh, and don't forget the My Gloss on Paul, 109. That's great.
Great. You know, Brian, he's got the exact page numbers. That's pretty good, eh, for a guy who can't read.
And
yeah,
the worst of all possible Philistines, 119.
Yes. Let me read a bit of these. Are there any McLuhan? You've
oh,
got the original book.
They're not very meaningful.
Just a minute. I'm going to mute you just for a second. I need to highlight Brian. So Brian, this was McLuhan's copy of the original book, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Like it's a hardback. It's published by Chatto and Windus in 1931 and has this, you know, books were smaller back then, bigger print.
Yeah.
And it's like a pamphlet almost, more in the book compared
to
today.
Yeah, there's not very many sentences on a page.
Right. Okay, so in Ian says, page 20, the political Philistine. Lewis writes, a printed form exploding with a dozen or more caustic questions is often sent out by any advanced review of high standing, review like Transatlantic, to a select list of advanced writers of high standing. These are asked a variety of facetious questions. Else, as with the questionnaire of transition put through a solemn catechism where the modes are mixed. Perhaps if I borrowed that device and wrote one myself upon the spot or imagined an interview with a personal canvasser, I should clear up with a sort of emphasis adapted to the hurried man some pressing difficulties of certain readers, confusions attend necessarily upon the working of a critical system so complex as mine. Here, then, is such a dialogue in which an inquisitorial political art journalist attempts to extract all my critical teeth one by one. So then there's several pages of this fake interview that Lewis lays out that are the kind of interviews that a transition magazine sends out to so-called high-standing authors. And I just checked with Ian. Did you say, Ian, on page 31, the new Philistinism was the next quote? I think he said yes.
The political right? Philistine. The political Philistine is on 20.
Right. Then what's the page? Then the new Philistinism? Is that the next one, or what was the next quote? Next page.
No, hatred as a necessary drug, 75.
75. Okay. So he has here, but connected very intimately indeed with the urge to infinity, infinity in quotes, and the relation that it bears in many cases to the power complex, in quotes, is another question. You will recall above how the posturing of Isidore mainly turned upon a loudly advertised malevolent scorn of other men. He praised the octopus and told it how beautiful it was and pointed out to that marine monster how exceedingly vain and smug it was of human beings to call themselves beautiful, and it a monster, a thing to point at. First, they should point at themselves, says Isidore, I guess.
I think that's Lotriamont.
He's talking about Lotriamont, okay. Yeah, so he says, this vein of rage and hatred against mankind is an essential ingredient in all nihilism, and therefore in all new romanticism. That is what is meant by the new, that it is romanticism that's peculiarly given over to an intolerant, exclusive hatred of the rest of the world. It's what some people call Gnosticism. It's worthwhile to examine this, for evidently it has a great deal to do with giving evil a chance or devoting yourself to the diabolical principle, as Eugene Jolas, editor of Transition, recommends. So he goes on about that. Then the next one was 93, It was 93. The vulgarization.
The vulgarization of the vision.
Of genius to political ends. So Lewis talks about his own book written 5 years before, 6 years before. In the chapter From the Art of Being Ruled, from which I've just quoted, you will find a true account, I believe, of the vulgarization of disgust. So he kind of predicted what Transition and those types would become, as I called it, vulgarization of disgust, for the benefit of the magnate class and of their servants. But with our friends Paul Jolas and Sage, you have another sort of vulgarization of disgust, even more disgusting. So he's disgusted with them. Now Croker talks about the internet world, or at least the 80s world, spreading, popularizing of disgust. That was a major effect that Croker saw. Again, a replay of Lewis. Lewis says, I refer to the vulgarization of the authentic and lofty detachment of the supermen. Oh, you read this, didn't you? Didn't you, Brian?
Yeah.
Shakespeare, Pascal, and Machiavelli, and the penetrating truth of the vision of life. Now, how did you have that? Did you write all that out?
I wrote out that a couple paragraphs around there, yeah.
Okay, we did that. So then the next one is 119.
Do the Magloss. No, jump to the Magloss on Paul, 109.
No, people, Ian's not looking at the book. Ian knows everything. My gloss
from
on
1930,
Paul.
The one, who in the world reads Percy anyway? It's the most ridiculous thing that's ever been written. Festus on Gunsmoke was more prolific than this gibberish.
Who was more prolific? Who?
Festus. Festus on Gunsmoke was more prolific than this Percy. This Percy idiot. It's ridiculous.
Percy Wyndham Lewis. Percy O'Reilly in Finnegan's Wake. My gloss on Paul, I think it means Elliot Paul. I will run through this article paragraph by paragraph, offering you a kind of paraphrase as commentary. People were surprised at such a colossal event as the war, and I suppose Paul means the Russian Revolution too, of which the war was but a gigantic episode. People were surprised at such a colossal event as the war had no visible reflection in literature. They were even dismayed to find how little effect it had. So people were surprised the colossal events of war had no visible... And with more reason, it may be justifiably added, many of us have been dismayed at the absence of intelligent response and violent protest evoked by such things outside of literature in everyday life. I think I may claim that these books and pamphlets of mine are one of the only responses of the sort. People were stunned. They just sat down and ceased reacting or thinking at all in response to the war, World War I. The older men lost their grip and succumbed to a profound discouragement. That's in quotes. Those whose active life was mainly behind them naturally could neither grasp in their full scope, nor were they competent to meet these novel catastrophes. But the young men whose work had been interrupted in its formative stage were, we are told, in no better plight. They had to begin all over again, but in an atmosphere of profound disillusion. That's what historians say killed the Vorticist movement, this disillusion after the war. And Lewis admitted he was quite affected by the war. So Lewis says, but what did Elliot Paul expect? Did he expect those whose work had been interrupted immediately sit down, the war just over, and respond to these events like so many machines? And exactly what sort of response did he anticipate? The war for me as a soldier was an interminable nightmare, and I did not, the instant it was over, sit down pencil in hand, as Mr. Dunn recommends, to get onto paper its prophecies. So great books were not forthcoming. Paul is careful not to say that had great books of the kind he has in mind been forthcoming, Paul would have been the last person to welcome them. And on he goes. So the next part, 119, Ian?
Yeah. Now go to, no, go to 49. You got to talk about the breath of Satan.
Okay, do you see, and when I'm reading, there was a commentary by McLuhan on the 93 stuff, right? The vulgarization of the vision of genius, Brian?
No, not an actual commentary, just a that
he noted it
in his like back page with
the numbers. Oh, I see. It's Isidore de Lotriamont. Yeah, that's what he's talking about. So in 49, am I supposed to read Maldoror Ion or the sentence before it? The commentary by
down toward the end. Down toward the end, we're talking about the breath of Satan, and I can't love you. I hate you. That's why you tell me you like me, but shut up or kill me. See? Perfect Imperfection got this right.
Perfect Imperfection,
so
yeah.
There you go.
Kevin Gates.
There you go.
Played that a few minutes ago.
Painfully, my fellows, who, from the most ironical contrast with you, the most comical antithesis. I cannot love you, I hate you. Why? For a thousandth time do I come back.
Right, that's Kevin Gates, but... Here's what.
Percy.
I didn't see that part, but I'm reading Lotriamont. Lotriamont says, "I cannot love you. I hate you. Why? Oh yeah. You just said it for the thousandth time, didn't you? That's not Percy. That's Lotrimont. You're inaccurate. Why, for the thousandth time, do I come back?
So
he reads what I was looking for, Brian. I was trying to find the part to begin, and he reads it. Why, for the thousandth time, do I come back to your friendly?
Don't tell how wrong we were.
Well, it's not Lewis. It's Lotrimont. Do I come back to your friendly arms that half open to kiss my burning brow, which sees its fever vanish at their contact? I do not know your hidden destiny, but everything which concerns you interests me. Tell me then if you are the dwelling place of the Prince of Darkness. Tell me, ocean, only to me, whether the breath of Satan makes a tempest which lifts your salty waters to the clouds. You must tell me, because I would be happy to know hell so near mankind. Now, and then Lewis says, the Lay of Maldor, which we just read, and Zarathustra, that's Nietzsche, have this much affinity, that they're both Byronic, oh, there's the Byron point that Ian's talking about, both Byronic, declamatory, and romantic prose poems. Both their authors are Satanists, but Lotrimont is very far even from an Ossian. He is, as a matter of fact, a kind of happy mixture of the Marquis de Sade and Frederick Nietzsche, but without remarkable talent. His lays or poems are full of the juiciest machinery of inverted dope diabolics. Now, does McLuhan comment on this section here?
What page was that?
Page 50. It's part of the communist prose board. It's about Lotrimont.
Yes, actually. Well, I didn't see a comment. I didn't get to that page, I guess. But in his first note, actually, it's page 50, Maldoror Lotrimont.
Yeah, that's what I'm reading.
McLuhan references that to page 72, where he's written horror as vindictive power complex.
Right. Lewis is saying, I can give you a few specimens of Lotrimont translated from Transition. So he's saying Transition is celebrating the disgust of Lotrimont. These quotes from Transition, they are not the best Lotrim can do, says Lewis, but they are typical of his outlook and save me the trouble of translation. The satanic flavor prevailing throughout his lays is fully presented for your inspection. It is the order of satanic romanticism popularized by Huysmans in Labab. Huysmans was someone that McLuhan wrote about. Had Victor Hugo become enamored of the philosophy of the Marquis de Sade and gone to work in the same Gothic spirit shown perhaps more fully in his remarkable drawings than in his writing, you would have got something of the sort. It's a very tiresome and monotonous bellow. So this is a good criticism of the church subgenius. Is that what you're saying, Brian?
Oh,
no, but we are.
Somewhat. I mean, I was referring to what he had written later about the vulgarization of disgust, but that too as well. I mean, I don't think the subgenius really fall into the, because Lotrimont is very much taking himself extremely seriously. And,
yeah.
Subgenii would be falling victim more to the vulgarization of that detachment.
Yes.
The lofty detachment and the contempt of the sub-Superman, as he put it. Like, he kind of really nailed it with the sub-Superman. Like, that really is the one that they are more afflicted with.
Yes, yes, the Superman.
That's on page 93.
Yeah, and I guess the subgeniuses are only yelling at two-thirds of humanity, not all of mankind, because they claim one-third is subgenius. Mm. So there's a grandfather clause, a clause of escape clause there? Because it's not all of humanity. Okay.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, what's on the next page? You want any other point you want me to point out, read? Well, there's Wyndham Lewis commenting on Laura Riding, who O.J. goes on and on about. Laura Riding is the person that O.J. thinks outdoes Lewis. And here on page 154, he's quoting Laura Riding. That's interesting. Okay, if I had read that before,
what about
I would have
diabolic? Known. What about diabolic, Bob?
What page is that on? You got a particular part?
It's a different book. It's a different book.
Earlier he had said that hatred of stupidity will, if it's indulged in widely, will have the most diabolical result.
Yeah, Ian, do people who listen to Ian at first start to hate their neighbors and their friends because of some massage you've done to them? That is a common reaction. People get very antisocial.
Delusions of perfectibility.
Ah, perfect delusions of perfectibility. Yeah, oh, that's a good point. You get that, Ions? At first, you think
age.
That...
We are... Yeah, we told you that we get it.
I meant I said Ions. I mean Ionettes. Are you hearing that, Ionettes? This is what happens to all of you when you first hear Ion. He implies that you can
perfect
yourself.
That's what happened to D.H. That's what happened to D.H. Lawrence, especially.
Yeah, yeah, good point.
Not quite so sardonic, is he?
See, the Ion, he sounds like Edgar Friedenberg or Robert Fulford or any critic that was, you know what.
The heart of darkness.
Yeah, Joseph Conrad. Edmund Wilson. Ion sounds like Edmund Wilson.
And Conrad's laugh.
Conrad Flaff?
Black?
Oh, Black? Conrad Black, good point. Conrad Black tries to retrieve that point with his tomes, his massive. He's in jail. He wrote many of his books in jail. His latest books. Did you know that, Brian? Conrad Black?
Yeah, he was in jail for a while. Yeah, and he kind of, he tries to wear that fairly proudly these days.
Yes, he was disgusted. Very perceptive, Ion.
Getting all trusted there to the faulty thing.
Right.
Don't forget about Kurtz.
Kurtz from the Heart of Darkness? Yes.
Yes,
the Heart of Darkness. That's Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now.
Well, horror. Intellectual horror. Gaze, maybe. An inverted dedication.
Look at Ion engaging the labyrinth of the mind with fine sophistication.
It's a slippery slope for us too. It's a mood of a bleak-eyed illusion.
Pretty good, Brian. Brian, give us relief. Give us another quote or something that McLuhan noted.
The concentration of the deviant of the intellectual gaze. Yeah.
Is that in this book? What page is that?
We've moved on to diabolic now, Bob.
Oh, you mean, who's that guy? They all quote now, the surrealist critic. Bataille. Are you quoting Bataille, B-A-T-A-I-L-L-E, Ion? George Bataille?
No.
When you go into diabolic.
No.
He's a colleague. can you think, Brian, who could I be quoting? The diabolic. Is that Nietzsche?
Wyndham Lewis. Croker.
Okay, well, he...
Wyndham Lewis,
I don't
diabolic.
I'm looking up and finding words like the diabolical principle and the dithyrambic spectator.
That's the name of the book we're doing right now. But there's no chapter
All the way up to the tranquil waterway, ends the earth, swallowed up, the vision of Kurtz on a stretcher, open his mouth voraciously, devour the earth with all of mankind, page 245. I mean, you know.
Oh, you're doing the Heart of Darkness. That's what you're quoting, the Heart of Darkness.
Moves all the way through, yeah.
All right. Back to you, Brian. Give us another, we'll just put that on hold for next time. I don't have the Heart of Darkness in my library.
What? The 97,384,000,000 it's spent on that goddamn library, and you don't even have the works that you're working with, Bob? Wow, this is very tragic indeed.
Yeah, okay, go ahead, Brian. Give us a McLuhan note. Get me out of this hellhole I've driven into.
Okay, on the next page after where Lewis was talking about the audience basically becoming part of the audience becoming an audience of critics, and that they're as active as the performer who exists chiefly in order that the critic may act as a critic.
What page is that? What page?
That's page 170, and then on page 171, there's a note beside where Wyndham Lewis continues saying, there would be no professional performers if the audience had not become, in some sense, a professional audience. But
right.
Already, in proportion as the technical standard declines, the performers, except for a very few privileged stars, are more often than not recruited directly from the audience. They return to the audience when their summary performances are terminated. And beside that, McLuhan has written Beatles.
What?
McLuhan has written Beatles, like the band.
The Beatles. Wow.
Yeah, beside that, the idea of the performers being recruited directly from the audience and returning to the audience when their summary performances are terminated.
Amazing.
And then let me just, it continues on. I mean, and it gets even more astounding, like, yeah, Beatles, but then it ends up being a very good prediction of the, as this trend continues, to the, like, American Idol plus social media situation. There's the community of the stage and of the auditorium is becoming absolute. But it is hardly any longer correct to refer to this audience as composed of critics. The critic is, on the one hand, enough of an amateur performer, and on the other hand, enough of a passive and voluptuous spectator to get a thrill of sorts. Always, at all events, the critic is too much of both to be unbiased, of both amateur performer and spectator.
Wow.
The critic stage, the point at present reached in the Western evolution of the authentic expression, is halfway between the spectator and the full effective crowd performer.
The critic is.
Yeah.
The figure.
Which gives you a working example of the distance between the roaring queen and the rude assignment.
Awesome. Those are two Wyndham Lewis books. The Roaring Queen is about a critic, the character we're talking about, the beginning of the expert, and the rude assignment is Lewis describing biographically his literary life, I think, that book. Mm-hmm. But that's very good, Ion. Very good. I'm going to read the rest of what you didn't have the rest, right?
We love Tar, too.
Tar is a novel, 1919, that competed with Joyce's The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. They both analyzed the art world.
Yes. Mm. And the insignificance thereof, and the insignificances thereof.
Right. He's pretty good, Brian. Lewis, he understands art is over. And McLuhan's writing in the 50s that Pound should have given up in 1922. Lewis understands why they should have given up their Gutenberg arts. What?
Right.
What did you say, Ayn? That's the answer? What did Ayn just say?
I didn't hear.
What'd you say, Ian? That's the answer? Oh, well. Lewis continues, always at all events, the amateur is too much of both to be unbiased. At the end of this essay, the fusion of audience and stage personnel will be seen to bear a strong resemblance to the triumph of the, and it's in Greek writing, I don't know fucking Greek, I mean, to triumph of the blah, 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 as described by Aristotle. Well, what is that Greek word, Ion? What does that Greek word mean? Let's see how Ion is on its Greek. Did Ion disappear? Let's check. Let's see. Ion is not there. Ion has dropped off for a minute. I assume he'll be back.
Let me see the Greek
word. I would guess that word would mean hoi polloi or crowd or audience or something.
Mm. Oh, okay. Will be seen to bear a strong resemblance to the triumph of the hoi polloi as described by Aristotle. And then he says, or in that contemporary school of anthropology and folklore that has given a new lease of life to classical research originating with the work of Sir James Fraser, as traced by the late Miss Harrison in her popular book, Ancient Art and Ritual. I know that Lewis criticizes Miss Harrison a lot. The critic stage, the critic italicized, the critic stage, the point at present reached in the Western evolution of authentic expression, is halfway between the spectator and the full effective crowd performer. Did you just read that, Brian?
Yes.
Oh, okay, you jumped ahead. Then he says, the first part of this essay will expound briefly a recent and brilliant account of the origin of the fine arts, an account with a bias directed to show the supremely vital character of their earliest functions. And from that I will pass to a very different account of their origin, also with a bias. Note how Harold Innes is is naming his book, influenced by Lewis, called The Bias of Communication. Also with a bias is Lewis, but this time an unintelligent doctrinaire and political bias in favor of vitalist explanation, vitalism. And we'll be dealing with that in a minute. Namely, that contained in Miss Harrison's little book. Maybe I should just read this a little bit. That art started on its long career, or rather that it first started being a substantial factor in human life as a sort of elixir or life giver, is what Dr. Elliot Smith's book, The Evolution of the Dragon, sets out to show. That it was hand in hand not only with magic, but with the doctor and anatomist that art made its debut, that the site of its first serious efforts was Egypt, and it began as a purveyor of immortality, he affirms. Purveyor of immortality. Fallen man doesn't know it's immortal, so he tries to become immortal through art. Quoting this Elliot Smith, the sculptor who carved the portrait statues for the Egyptian's tomb was called Sank, he who causes to live. And the word to fashion a statue is to all appearance identical with to give birth. Unquote. It was hand in hand with the great mother or with Aphrodite, surrounded by the vulvas of cowrie shells and assisted by mandrake roots in the same workshop as the embalmer and primitive physician, that the artist began his terrestrial career. Isn't that interesting? Start off as medicinal. Art was medicinal. Then it goes into mummification. So, okay, Brian, any other quotes?
This is exactly where McLuhan has more, the only place I found longer notes was on, I guess he's gotten to page about 173 there?
Yes, that's 173 I was reading. Is that what he notes?
At the top of page 173, McLuhan writes, Lewis wants art to be totally environmental, not as content.
Okay, you're blipping out. Say that loudly again.
At the top of page 173, McLuhan wrote, Lewis wants art to be totally environmental, not as content.
Yeah, that's, you'll see in the famous McLuhan article on William Burroughs, he says Burroughs and James Joyce take on the idea of the Egyptian art, which is the pharaoh or the artist programs the whole environment. So he's saying Lewis is doing that first. And that's pretty interesting that Lewis, and he praises Lewis in that article on Burroughs, but Lewis is the one who figures out that 20th century art must be environmental. That's pretty good.
And on the next page, on page 174, where around where responding to where there's a quote about man has always been seeking an elixir of life to give added vitality to the dead.
Yeah.
Around there, there's a note by McLuhan has written on that page, environment as artifact, magician as maker of environment as artifact equals Murray Schafer.
Yes, that's Murray Schafer was the composer, the Canadian composer, who would do these environmental compositions musically. And he wrote a book, Tuning the Sky, that McLuhan would refer to. And
That phrase pretty well evokes this magician as maker of environment as artifact.
Right. Now, I attended a Murray Schafer lecture at Bruce Powell's course, 2007 maybe, and Murray Schafer, as a student of McLuhan, said that he would have the students sit in a circle, and he'd sit in the middle, and he'd swirl around on his chair responding to different students. And it was there that Murray Schafer, in 1951, first heard the statement that Finnegan's Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. And Murray Schafer later goes on to do many of his art musical compositions on CBC. Like he'd get out in the woods or something and make that part of his environment. So I'm telling you, the inspiration was McLuhan. And, of course, McLuhan knows that and refers to Schafer in this book. So the question would be to ask Schafer, is he aware that Lewis was doing it or trying to do it first? That'd be the question for Murray Schafer, who's still alive.
Yeah, or whether what that kind of in just environmental content, whether that style is really in the Lewisian tradition or whether it's more an extension of something Lewis was going to criticize. Like is that
the environmental position.
Yeah, is that more of a primitive idea?
No, that's Lewis. This is where in 1919 he writes that book, O Caliph, The Caliph Design, architects, where is your vortex? And he criticizes Picasso and the artists of Paris as making dinky little paintings in studios, where Lewis says, us genius artists should go into city planning and design cities and towns, not stupid little paintings. So that's Lewis being the environmental artist.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think of that, people? Let's see if anybody else could comment on that artistically. Nope, there's nobody qualified here to speak on those matters. They're all New Age flakes here in the audience at this point. I don't see anybody with an art PhD. Well, maybe Ginny has something to say. Ginny, would you have anything on the aesthetic level to discuss, respond to what we're saying here? Or Greg, you're registered to be listening. No comment? Maybe Bill has a comment. Let's ask Bill. Bill, do you have a comment as a maker of environments? Your chief radio is an environment, Bill. Traditional outlook. You must make allowance for that. The latter results in most men living in an historic past. They still think in terms of institutions and of emotional appeals that no longer possess the slightest rationale or basis in fact. In terms of anything, in short, except of that present reality. Wait, they still think in terms of anything, in short, except of that present reality that flatly contradicts all those formal or empty survivals, which to them appear, quote, the things that matter. In other words, Lewis is saying everything's disappeared.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and especially because McLuhan would put a lot of emphasis on the, you know, making it sort of my main discovery, the most astonishing discovery. He would really emphasize people's resistance.
Okay, Brian, you've got to speak louder. Carolyn's complaining, so
okay.
try that again, but loud.
McLuhan would always strongly emphasize his amazement at people's resistance.
Yes.
Understanding after ostrich in the sand.
Yeah.
Romantic outlook of being in the past, the
right.
Rearview mirror, that was amazing, their capacity for it, that you have to make an almost unlimited allowance for it. That is very McLuhan.
You're right. Then so that is McLuhan, and then, remember, McLuhan says in the 40s he will carry on Lewis's work. So he was a good student of Lewis, and he knew what Lewis said. So it says in the next paragraph, to show by a concrete example that this is so, you only have to consider marriage as still practiced today. Men are liable to a woman they have married as though no sex revolution had ever occurred. So men are liable to a woman they have married, in quotes, married, in brackets, to the extent of a forfeiture of a third of their goods. They have to give up their goods as though no sex revolution has ever occurred. And, you know, we're talking about what happened in the cities of sin in those documentaries a few weeks ago that showed the, erotic chaos of the 20s in Paris, Berlin, and Shanghai, and I guess London, and New York. So I think Lewis is referring to that. With its total revaluation or reversal of all the sex relationship, he also talked about women's lib. That revolution was not marked by a slaughter of the males. Wait, it has been ruined. That revolution was not marked by a slaughter of the males. It has been a revolution in the general state of mind, and so leaves our society in two contradictory pieces, one of which goes on behaving as though nothing had occurred. That is neither satisfactory from the point of view of the rebel hordes of feminism, nor from that of the bloody taskmaster and slave driver, poor little sentimental man, capital M, italicized. So that revolution having no formal legal status, as it were, the archaic machinery of marriage, with all the injustice it takes with it where the man is concerned, still grinds on like a cracked and disconsolate hurdy-gurdy. Then he has a statement in Mexican. Son semper la probeseto hombre copagan. Maybe Roxy could translate that. Maybe it's Spanish. Son siempre la probesetos hombres. Is hombres a Spanish word? K pagan. And in a thousand minor ways.
Bad guys,
master,
hombres, bad guys.
Bad guys. Who are pagan? Okay. And
yes.
In a thousand. Yeah. and in a thousand minor ways, the master, who is no longer even a mate, is made a fool of. He is abused for the possession of things he never dreamed of claiming, and generally made to pay, as he no doubtly richly deserves, for his little bourgeois home, and for his greater slowness in transforming himself and throwing off with a revolutionary gesture all responsibility. This is the Dagwood syndrome that McLuhan writes about in the Mechanical Bride. And yet people are surprised or shocked, so that they will not even allow you to say how prevalent it is at the homosexual cult, which is a direct outcome of this situation. The man escapes in italics. The man escapes. He ceases to be a man. The game is not worth the candle. I will not touch upon the many absurdities that accompany a nationalist war of gas and bomb. But there you could find an even more fruitful illustration of how men have collectively to pay with wealth, health, and blood for the extreme slowness with which they are able to seize the essentials of a novel situation, very slow at adapting to the present. It is not even then that I have no beliefs that could be described as political, but that no single individual can, as things are, effectively be anything politically at all, except quite simply a capitalist or a communist, in quotes. That's pretty advanced. Politically, if you do not thrill at the thought of the modern capitalist state and all that it entails, then you must be a communist. For who believes that for long socialism can avoid merging with the energetic communist minority? So there's no question of purely political identity at all. And there's no margin in which the individual can exist effectively outside these gigantic organizations. See, the superhuman dehumanization of people. Now, you know, in the 60s it was hip to say, well, I'm not for the right or left. They're both obsolete terms. But he's saying it 50 years before, 40 years before. Ian, do you have a comment on that?
The person is passe.
It won't let us talk right. So we can't talk well. We don't speak well. So we ain't saying nothing.
Yes, McLuhan talked about the decline of language. So that's pretty good stuff, Mr. Lewis.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean...
That stuff about, like, they're entitled to a third of my money, even as if this sex revolution never happened. Was that on page 144? You think that's what he meant by me?
Yes, he does. Yeah, because he writes that way. No, McLuhan takes on the feminists, Mary McCarthy and people, in a couple of articles that I have... in my archives in 46-47. They're called Out of the Counting House Into the Something. So he goes on and explains why men, they give up the male-female thing and they just sort of retreat into homosexuality.
King in his counting house counting out his money.
Yes. And the title is From the Counting House Into the Outhouse? Not sure what it's called. But, Ian, what do you say about the homosexuality cult? Are you for the cult or against it or indifferent?
We think they're going to do what they do whether you say it's illegal or not.
Right, so it's a natural inclination of human beings to be homosexual. Or to do
we
whatever
they're
going to
do what they do. We just want them to nut. We don't care where they do it or how they do it or with whom they do it. So they nut. That's all that matters.
You mean have an orgasm? That's what nut means?
Do.
Climax? Okay. You're a Reichian. You're for Wilhelm Reich. You think the orgasm is very important.
Well, yeah.
Was Wilhelm Reich, was he on to this, or was he perverting it by emphasizing it too much?
He didn't even know what it was. He never had one, so he was not qualified to be so boisterously possessive.
That's pretty good. Wilhelm Reich never had an orgasm. That's why he emphasized it.
It's
a good one. That's a big secret. You know, I don't know where I saw it, Dylan's wife, Sarah, the one that he separated with in the late 70s, she got into the Oregon box, William Reich's Oregon box. That's what I remember about her.
Okay,
Sarah.
Cool. Yeah.